Hello, and welcome to the River's Edge Church Podcast, Extra Conversations with Pastor Dave. We're excited to share another episode with you today. And now, here's Pastor Dave.
Hello, welcome. It's me, Pastor Dave. I am doing another episode of Extra Conversations on the Book of Revelation. So if you have been with us, you know that we've been in a series on the Book of Revelation, and we've been looking at it pretty intensely, actually. And so I'm taking this is not a sermon, obviously. This is just extra conversations, because for Easter Sunday, I preached on Revelation 5, and I talked about it essentially being this idea of the risen Christ in heaven, and sort of heaven from an what are the implications of heaven, of the resurrection from a heavenly perspective? So Jesus raises from the dead, and what does that mean? And what we focus on a lot is that, one, he didn't win by being a lion, he won by being a lamb. And I'll talk a little bit more about that today, but just briefly, since I covered it so much on Sunday. And then we also talked about how he was able to preside over all of human history. He got this scroll. And I want to talk a little deeper about that scroll today. And then there's just a few other things that I want to get to that I didn't really get to talk about, because it's Easter Sunday, you know, where I'm trying to keep it light. We've got a lot of visitors that Sunday, and how do you do one of the most obscure books of the Bible in a light and white way that people can like really know? And so that's what I did, but maybe it was too light. I'm not sure. I still did 30 minutes on it, and I thought, oh man, that's probably about the extent of what I want to go on Easter Sunday. So let's just dig right in. Revelation 5 comes right after chapter 4, probably the most obvious thing I've ever said. And if you remember from chapter 4, there's this incredible scene of worship unfolding in heaven. After John writes these letters to the churches, and if you recall, I did say this in a message before, chapters 4 and 5 are the theological center of the book. They are the heavenly throne room scene. So if you can just kind of close your eyes and think about this, the structure for a second. Chapter 1, you see Jesus, and he's announcing essentially that that he's giving this vision, and it's a letter to the churches. And so essentially, that's what you're getting. And then you see in chapters 2 and 3, the letters to these seven churches, and 5 out of the 7 churches have negative things to say. 2 of them, God doesn't say anything negative. He says, keep going, keep enduring. And the challenge with those two is that they're poor and they're suffering. And he's like, good job. You did it. Keep going. And I always think that's amazing, because it's just so counter to the wisdom that we have in our world today. That it's like, oh man, we don't have enough money. We have money. God's blessing us. Well, you know, it actually looked a little bit different back in those days. It's like, hey, you're not participating in this evil nation, essentially, of Rome, and you're not participating in the trade or the well-being of that nation, which involved a lot of like really just demonic worship. And so these churches were being praised for that. So chapters 4 and 5 are set up as a heavenly throne room scene, and this is a divine judgment scene. So if you think about the divine judgment, you have to think about the word lawsuit. This is a lawsuit. So chapters 2 and 3 essentially are the kind of the lawsuit against the churches. You know, some of them have good evidence, great evidence, and some of them have just terrible evidence, things that they need to turn around. And then in chapter 5, we see a scroll. We're going to look at that in just a second here. And in chapter 5, there's this scroll, and then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose out of the rest of the chapters. And, you know, that is the judgment on the nations. So it's set up to say that chapter 4 and 5, right there in the beginning, God is the judge, and first he judges his church. He's looking at us first, folks. So, you know, it's one of those things. He's coming back. Be prepared for the return of Jesus. Don't be like the virgins not trimming their wicks and all that stuff. Like, you know, just be ready in season and out for the return of Jesus. That's essentially what they're trying to say. Like, if there's things you need to repent of, repent and be ready for his return. So that is, and then the rest we're going to see on this, like this new character starts to pop up here soon, Babylon. And Babylon, of course, is a dead monolithic, megalithic empire that is dead now, 500 years dead. And yet John, the author, likes to talk about Babylon a lot. And we're going to see there's a lot of Old Testament reasons for that, a lot of comparative reasons. Ooh, Monday after Easter, folks, I'm yawning. So a lot of comparative reasons why from the Old Testament. We'll get to that too. So let's look at chapter 5 then. Then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written on the back, sealed, written on within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. Now, well, let's pause right there. So the right hand motif is a big motif in the Old Testament, right? The right hand of God is kind of like the powerful hand of God. And so it's just saying like that he's sitting on a throne. Like this sentence is set up to communicate power, that God is sitting on the throne, and in his right hand, in his most important hand, is this most important scroll. And it's written within and on the back. So like, maybe John could see some of the writing. You know, we don't know. But one of the interesting things about this scroll sealed up with seven seals is that nowhere in the book of Revelation does anybody read the scroll. The contents of the scroll are not laid out for everyone to see. All we see are the effects of its opening. And so you're going to see that in the next chapter, this coming Sunday, chapter 6. You'll see that more and more. The effects of the scroll will be shown. And there's some question too as to like, well, what on earth is written in this scroll? A lot of scholars have thought about this. This is not like necessarily something new that scholars, like, oh man, didn't even think about that question. No, they've been thinking about this for years. And so there's a few clues to where John might've been getting this. One of the clues is Ezekiel chapter 2. And in Ezekiel 2, there's this whole commentary about like, hey, son of man, he keeps calling Ezekiel son of man. And he's like, eat this scroll, you know. And the idea is that in Ezekiel does all this weird stuff, right? Like God's like, bake bread and use human feces. And Ezekiel protests and he doesn't do it. And God says, okay, fine, don't do it that way. But he like has to lay on his side for 3 years. He like grows wild hair. He just does all this crazy stuff in there that God has him do. And what God's doing is having Ezekiel be this sort of like living embodiment of the way that Israel is acting towards God. And this living embodiment, like he's a prophet to God's people. So he's trying to tell them the truth about their actions and their life. So right in the beginning of his ministry, God tells Ezekiel this in Ezekiel 2:9-10. And when I looked, behold, a hand was stretched out to me, and behold, a scroll of a book was in it. And he spread it before me. And it had writing on the front and on the back, and there was written on it words of lamentation, mourning, and woe. Ouch. Do you see the, in essence, the same idea, words on the front and on the back. And in Revelation 5, it says from within and on the outside. So it's like kind of the same thing. The words on the scroll are both inside and out. And even Ezekiel doesn't read us the scroll. Like we don't see what Ezekiel's reading, but he just says words of lamentation, woe, and mourning. And that would essentially make us think that they're words of judgment. Now, what I said on Sunday is like God's will on earth as it is in heaven. I mean, that's all judgment, right? I was just trying to make it as understandable for people, like an obscure text is understandable for people as it can be on Easter Sunday. And so well, that's one of the things I talked about is God's will on earth as it is in heaven, God's all of human history, that Jesus is the only one who could preside over all of human history. Well, essentially in that scroll, if it's words of judgment, which I think it is, then essentially what it is God saying, here's what's really true. Here's what's really right. Here are my standards. And as human history unfolds, as we keep going towards this eventual return of Jesus, you know, like you got to live my way. And it's painful when those seals are popped and opened up. And I don't know, and God's plan begins to unfold a little bit because people are not living God's way. And it's an extremely challenging thing in that regard. So I think that both they're not like necessarily opposing each other, but I think it's just a different way of saying it. So, I think it is God's judgment. But I also think it's fine to say God's will for human history, God's will for all of history, God presiding over human history, just all that. I think that that's all just as appropriate theologically to say. But as long as we understand that there's a little bit of judgment there. And Daniel chapter 12 is also another kind of clue in on this, because essentially an angel is telling Daniel, like, hey, the end is coming, and write these words down in a book. And he's like, when is this? And he's like, oh, a time after a time. And Daniel's like, I don't understand. And the angel's kind of like, okay, good. You know, fine, don't understand. That's you're not supposed to understand it yet. And so there's some more scroll motif there. But the point is, like, most scrolls are rounded. And the picture I put up on the screen was of a cylinder scroll sealed with seven seals. And, you know, you can't read the scroll by just popping one. You can't read it just by just popping two. So when you're reading on in the text, and it's like, after the first scroll, you know, a horseman descended from heaven and blah, 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 blah. You know, you're not reading the scroll there. You're just seeing the effects of one of the seals being opened. And, you know, we talked about this. If you start thinking about, like, why does the earth freak out when we think about God coming and Jesus returning? Why is the world freaking out? Well, if you go back to the sermon that I preached right before the Revelation series, I talked about this supernatural worldview. And I talked about this little unknown theology of Jesus descending into the grave and proclaiming to the captives. And that's been talked about that for generations, for centuries, that Jesus died, descended to hell, and then rose again. Well, what on earth does that mean? So if you go back to that sermon, essentially what I was the point I'm making there is that Jesus is proclaiming not to people, they're not humans that are the captives. These are rebellious spirits, demonic rebellious spirits that rebelled against God. It goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 6 and the idea of these watchers coming down, impregnating women, and, you know, making these Nephilim children and stuff like that. So these are imprisoned spirits. And Jesus goes down there and says, look, I've sealed the victory. I've defeated death. I died on the cross for my people's sins. And, you know, I'm down here, but guess what? I get to leave. And I'm taking the keys with me. And, you know, you can't come with me. And in fact, all of your evil is going to be banished at one point. And so that's what happened between Easter Sunday and Good Friday. That's in 1 Peter 3. John talks about, why do we talk about it? He ascended. I mean, not John, Paul, the Apostle Paul says, what does it mean to say he ascended without saying he descended? And so, like, there's clues of this all over the Bible, but a lot of times they're just odd and obscure, and we kind of, like, you know, scoot past them as to not deal with them. So essentially, my point is that as it's sooner and sooner and sooner for Jesus to come back, the world does freak out quite a bit more. Why? Because evil knows its days are numbered. Evil knows that in the final triumph of the Lamb, in the final judgment of God, that evil will no longer exist and that it will be completely banished and destroyed forever. And so, yeah, our world freaks out when the seals are popped, because that just means that it's so much sooner that this scroll is going to be read. And that's why the world freaks out. So that's verse one. See why we're doing an extra podcast on this. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" Now, that question we focused on Sunday, and I'll just say it and move on because we already focused on it. Who's worthy? Because in a royal edict, only the person that actually opens the scrolls, I keep saying pop them because they're wax, and when wax is dried, it just kind of all pops off at once. So when you pop those seals, only the person who opens the seals is able to carry out the edicts that are contained within the writing of the scroll. So you can't have somebody read this and go, "Oh no, I don't want to do that." You do it. No, it's a royal order. If you are ordered to open that scroll, then you have to carry it out. So Jesus wrote, right now they say, no one is worthy. And then it says, and no one on heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or look into it. And again, you're going to see this twice in chapter 5. There's this kind of three-tiered cosmology understanding there. No one in heaven, so kind of like in the air above us, on earth or under the earth. This is three-tiered cosmology, a way of understanding the world, was worthy to open. And so John weeps because no one could open the scroll. And verse 4 says, and I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more, bro. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." So the idea of a lion, when Israel bestowed his final blessing onto his son, he compared Judah with a lion. And Israel, obviously Jacob, when Jacob gave his final blessing to his son, he conquered, he compared Judah with a lion and foresaw this perpetual royal dynasty coming from Judah's line. This is Genesis 49, 8 through 12, by the way. And then Isaiah foresaw that a fresh shoot from the stump of Jesse, who's David's father, who that royal line from Judah, all that stuff would come, would shoot up, and that there is a, that it seemed like from a hopeless place, right? And so this, there would be a shoot up. That's Isaiah 11, verses 1 and 10. So we get this lion language from the Old Testament, and we get that from Jacob's blessing of Judah. And of course, you have the Davidic kingdom that arose from that line. And so the Lion of the tribe of Judah, you know, they're talking about Jesus. They're saying, you know, if you look back at the Gospels and you see Jesus's lineage, he goes back to Judah. And so this whole lion conversation, it all goes back to Jesus. And of course, we spent a significant amount of time on this on Sunday. So, you know, we're not going to go deeply into this at all. Lion strong and powerful and all that stuff. And then one of the chief paradoxes of the book of Revelation, and there's more places that you see this. Verse 6 says, "And between the throne and the four living creatures, among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, and with seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth." So pause there real fast. He heard lion, but then he turned and saw lamb. This would be a paradoxical thing that will continue happening through the book of Revelation, that you'll hear one thing and turn and see another. And this is just a literary device that the author John likes to use and likes to kind of mess with his people. Not mess with them, but just is like, hey, Jesus, yeah, he is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He is the roaring lion, but he also is the lamb as well. He also conquered as the lamb. And we gave some significant discussion on this on Sunday, essentially, that, that you know, we all want a lion, we all want the strong man, all that stuff to conquer. We want the action hero, the Arnold Schwarzenegger, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that the only way that Jesus could really win was by using sacrificial love and laying his life down for the sake of others. And that's the idea of a lamb. And of course, it's a baby lamb. We talked about that on Sunday as well. And it says, and he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And then they sang a new song, and we'll talk about the song in a second. But what I want to talk about is a couple things. One, Jesus just walks up and takes the scroll. Like, no problem. This one's mine. This is what I've been called to do. He just walks up and takes it. Because, again, he's the only one worthy, and he's the only one that has the power and authority to carry out the will of his Father. And so he just walked up and took it. And then in verse 8, it talks about these four living creatures again. And one of the things we got to remember is that in the book of Revelation, we're working with numbers being symbols. They're not statistics. So the four living creatures, we've dealt with these four living creatures before in chapter 4. But it's kind of a way of saying all of creation. It's kind of like an ancient apocalypse way of saying all of creation. And then there's 24 elders, which, again, symbol, not necessarily a statistic, but probably it could be symbolic of the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles, but essentially this divine counsel of God, that God has this divine counsel. Go see Psalm 82. You know, there's all kinds of texts out there about the divine counsel. This was a worldview that they definitely had back in the day. It's not a question. It's like, it's not right now, like we talk so much in theology about, oh, well, maybe it can mean this, maybe it can mean that. Well, if this, then that. And we could just tell you that at this time in the first century under Second Temple Judaism, they fully understood this divine council worldview, that God had a council with him. And that was what was taught at the time. So there's no issue even talking about that at all. So all God's people and all of God's creation, I want you to get the picture of what's happening here. All of God's divine counsel and all of creation lay down before the throne. I just love that. Like, they all come to the throne and they all worship God, all creatures of our God and King. And it says that there's a golden bowl of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. I just want you to like think about that for a minute, like really process that, that in heaven, all of heaven and earth are laid prostrate before the King, worshiping God, singing a song, and there's this golden bowl there. And I don't know how it works, but it just essentially is full of the prayers of God's people. So when you pray, what John is saying in my vision, what I'm seeing is like when people pray, it comes right up there in the throne room of God, that you don't need anybody else. Like, you know, you don't. Jesus is our great intercessor, right? Jesus intercedes on our behalf to the Father. We don't need human intercessors, although we should be interceding for people. I have a friend right now who's got cancer, so I'm praying for him. I'm interceding on his behalf. I'm saying, Lord, would you please heal my friend with cancer? We don't need that, but we should be doing that, because right there in the bowl, right before God, are these prayers that are just kind of bubbling up all the time. And by the way, this is not the last time this bowl will be talked about in the book of Revelation. I want to say it's chapter 7. I don't have it up right now. But I want to say it's chapter 7 that it comes back up. But we'll definitely revisit this bowl. But my point is that that the whole entire earth, all creation, and that all of God's divine counsel are just laid down before God. And even the prayers that are being prayed to God by his people are just bubbling up before God. I don't know any better way to say it. I just love that picture. So verse 9 says, and then they sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals because you were slain. And with your blood, you purchased for God persons from every tribe, language, and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom priest and serve our God, and they will reign again on the earth. Then I looked and heard a voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and tens of thousands, 10 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the four living creatures and the elders. So essentially, this is a song that's being sung to the Lord. And apparently these people know a little bit more about what's to come than we do. And I love this. So first, these people encircled the throne. 10,000 was the largest number that the Greeks would have known on a regular, would use on a regular basis. So to say 10,000 times 10,000, again, is not a mathematical equation, but it's a Greek way of saying there's just an infinite amount of people worshiping before the throne room of God. And there's this deafening heavenly chorus saying we're purchased, we're bought by God, we're given a new identity in Jesus Christ as his child, and that we have a new identity. And then I love this, and you just really can't escape this. It says this, that we're made to be a kingdom of priests and all that stuff, and then they will reign again on the earth. Well, no, the people of God, I'm sorry, but you know, in John's time, they weren't reigning, the people of God. They were not reigning on earth. You know, so how could that be? Well, if your end times system tells you that the earth is going to be completely destroyed, and it doesn't matter what we do to earth, who cares? It's going to be completely gone. It's wasting away. You know, there are some texts that might say something like that, but what I think was more accurate is that like this human sinful system is wasting away. Because right here in Revelation chapter 5, verse 10, it talks about the saints of God reigning with Jesus again on the earth. Not necessarily in heaven, but back here. So like when the new heaven and the new earth come, we're going to reign on that. The people of God will be in charge and control. And it's not like you look at and what it means to be in charge and in control in Congress right now. And it means that you become a multimillionaire overnight because all of a sudden you're insider trading in Congress. I mean, I know this. Well, that's not even like a crazy thing to say. Just go look at it. You know, there's all these members of Congress that go in as, you know, doing pretty good in their life. And then all of a sudden they come out multimillionaires. Why? Well, because they're abusing their power. And that's what it means to reign in our society today, is to get in the seat of power and then use it for your own good. And there's precious few humans that don't fall victim to that. But what essentially is saying is that there will be a reign of God's people, the priestly people, here on earth. So if your end time system, whatever it is, tells you, you know, the earth is going away and the earth is going to be, you know, imploded or whatever, then that reality is probably not. Oh man, getting a call from the wife as I'm trying to finish this podcast. So I am going to try and finish this up quick, then give her a call back. Okay, Revelation 5, 12 through 14. In a loud voice, they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power, wealth, wisdom, and strength, and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, to praise and honor and glory, to be praise, honor, and glory and power forever and ever. Amen." The four living creatures said, "Amen," and the elders fell down and worshiped. I love this because it reiterates a point that only Jesus is worthy. He took his life back up again so he could take this scroll. And Revelation 5 reminds me of how big God is. This infinite picture of angels and creation worshiping him. And even, I mentioned this on Sunday, but it says like that creatures under the sea worshiped him. I mean, we're talking animals, we're talking whales, we're talking sharks, we're talking whatever. I mean, I know this is like a figurative text. I get that. But my point is that the throne room is seen as all of creation worshiping the Lord, all of them. your dog worships God. Like Jesus said, hey, if they're silent, the rocks will cry out. Like it is all of heavenly creation worship. Anything that Jesus has created, you have to remember, like animals are God's creation too, you know? And it's like when animals apparently see God on the throne, they worship. It's this kind of crazy thing. I know it's apocalyptic literature and all that stuff, but you have to kind of go with me on this, that this is what it's saying. And again, it has that three-tier cosmology above the earth, under the earth, and all that, and on the earth. So I guess my point is this. If I were to sum up Revelation 5, I would say it is the Tootsie Pop center of the lollipop. This thing is the theological center. It's the point in Revelation where the Lamb, Jesus, takes out of the right hand of God this scroll. And by the way, he goes and stands on the throne with God. And it talks about him, the seven spirits. It's sort of like this triune picture of the throne room. So if you're a theological student, you're looking for a great place for Trinity, I would say Revelation 5 is a great spot that the Trinity is like mentioned, the enthroned Father, Son, and Spirit. So you see him and you kind of see this eschatological end as well. Like humans are going to reign over the earth, on the earth. The followers of Jesus are going to reign on the earth and God's purposes will be carried out, but it's going to get really dark for a couple chapters. It's going to get really, really bad for a couple chapters. Why? Because when God's purposes begin to be unveiled for all of creation, evil freaks out. And you're going to see that. And you're going to see it a lot. So I hope that this has been as fun for you as it has been for me. That's our extra conversation on Revelation chapter 5. Be sure to email your questions in. We're taking them at media@recsac.org. And we've got a little small group that we've been doing of Q&R on the book of Revelation. And so be sure to email those in and we will do those conversations or those questions either in a future podcast or in that small group. So I hope you guys have a wonderful day and we look forward to seeing you every Sunday at 10 a.m. here at River's Edge Church.
Thank you for listening to the River's Edge Church podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that God has touched your heart through today's message. Please leave us a review and share with your friends. For more information about the ministries of REC, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. See the links in the description.